Hello, I'm Libby Robin, for those of you who haven't met me before, and I'm moderating this session, which means I'm going to give you an incredibly brief introduction to claiming the last addresses. This is the last session of the three big ones. What measures can be taken to co-shape the Anthropocene with all its geopolitical and sociopolitical impact? And it's interlinking the local and the global, and we've got some really exciting presenters, so I'm going to get them to do the work. The first group doing geopolitics is Adrian Lahoud, who people will have met yesterday moderating me, so we've done a swap. He's an architect and teacher in the Bartlett Architecture School at the University College London, and his thesis was called The City, the Territory, the Planetary, and it's a thesis on the idea of scale, which is obviously very relevant to the Anthropocene. And he will be accompanied by Nabil Ahmed, who teaches at London Metropolitan University in the School of Architecture, which is called CAS. He's an artist and a researcher, and he's doing his PhD concurrently at Goldsmiths University and in the Centre for Research Architecture, and his thesis title, which has just been submitted, is Earth Poison. So, Adrian and Nabil, thank you.
Thanks. We're going to sit down. Okay. So, I'm Adrian. This is Nabil. And we want to start today the presentation with a series of propositions. Then put to you a series of hypotheses afterwards, and then very briefly explain our seminar. Okay, so some propositions. The first one is that the Earth has no symmetry. And here we're picking up from something that was said yesterday around the idea of the cosmology. We know that historically cosmologies, the purpose of a cosmology was to orient you, to help you make sense of your relationship to the universe, to make a kind of scalar relationship between the microcosm and the macrocosm. The purpose of scale here is to kind of make sense of something, and we know the kind of examples of these things. Perhaps this is a kind of contemporary cosmology. Of course, it's the Earthrise image taken by crew members on Apollo 8. It's a photograph, and it's an image of the Earth as something unified, as something fragile, a kind of ecological whole, speaking of fragility, and we know that it gives birth to modern ecological movements.
But at the same time, it's a contemporary sort of form of cosmology. That very image that is supposed to be the image of this kind of unity is increasingly becomes a machinic image that is sort of a composite of satellites that sort of produce this idea of the Earth.
Yeah, I mean, so the second image, which is a kind of, it's not really an image actually. It's a visualization of a collective scientific effort. So this is a cloud model visualization run by some scientists from NASA. And so first of all, it's not a photograph, so there's no photographer, but there's a huge body of knowledge which sits behind the production of these kinds of images. It's something that's running on a computer. And the question we want to pose to you is, like, how do you start to understand something like that image? Do we still see this kind of image of fragility, a kind of ecological whole, or do we instead see a series of frontiers, a series of pressure differentials? And it's this idea of the frontier as a kind of line of difference or demarcation that we want to try to pick up on in this presentation.
So we need to calculate and trace violence. There's nothing that you can measure that man hasn't touched. And these are more and more things that are incorporated into the calculations. That does not lead to a greater amount of understanding, but rather it leads to a reorganization of dispute. Conflict follows calculus.
Yeah, so I think this is an important idea that, like, as more and more things get incorporated into a kind of calculus, the more things that we measure, that this doesn't simply give us more understanding of things. Actually, dispute follows that frontier of understanding, actually. And in fact, that frontier of understanding is reorganized through these technical forms of measurement. An example would be differences between, or the threshold of what kind of oil we take out of the ground, and we can see that that is now expanding to include things like heavy oils, tar sands, fracking, etc. There's an increasing axiomatization, in fact, of the Earth itself. Who would have thought that we'd be trading a molecule on a carbon market? I mean, these kinds of, increasing, let's say, like incorporation of measurement of the Earth. More and more things get kind of incorporated into a kind of calculus. And I guess we're interested in that kind of frontier, that moment in which there's a kind of ambiguity between what you can and what you can't calculate, and how those calculations become mobilized in different kinds of conflicts by different actors. So the next one, which is complexity is a medium of violence. This is interesting. I mean, I think on one hand, we have to try to see through complexity. I think that's part of the, complexity. There's lots of definitions of complexity. This is not really like an exact scientific agreement, but it has something to do with a kind of excess of variables, something that we can't quite get an epistemological handle on. And I think the interesting thing about complexity is that it also forms a kind of natural reserve of complication that can be exploited. Yeah. So if something like environmental violence, this is a piece I did for the, I worked on with some climate visualization experts for the Hackevert. And what it's trying to show is actually the kind of diffuse causal relationships that are characteristic of complex systems. And to say, in fact, that, okay, on one hand, we need to try to make sense of that. And the reason we need to try to make sense of that, of course, is because at that moment that cause and effect are kind of pulled apart, that pulling apart can be exploited for different kinds of environmental violence. That is to say, the link between the perpetrator and the crime is kind of obscured. And we know, of course, that that this is something that very large mining companies, as an example, can take full advantage of.
I think we're sort of presenting, in a sense, is to say that environmental violence, in the way that it reorganizes causality, is not sort of follows a specific format, but there are sort of different examples and different sort of ways they sort of reshape the way we do we sort of understand politics, and perhaps one of them is the question of scale that is quite urgent and sort of is sort of a term that we've been sort of discussing. We would sort of present the idea that scales contradict each other, that sort of the claims that sort of revolve around this notion of scale are always sort of partial, so we never really get a full picture of what the problem is. And there is no ultimate resolution, but rather that's something that sort of sets into motion different kinds of claims and at different scales.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. We want to push that sense that, in fact, we're just immersed in this force field. Yeah, and that oftentimes the resolution of a problem at one scale simply leads to a kind of transformation or the production of a new kind of problem at another scale. And in fact, there's no kind of, we want to take away that horizon of kind of resolution and actually just think about the way that those different scales start to interact with each other. And I think that's something that's actually very important within this kind of context of the Anthropocene.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, this is sort of an exercise in the way we're sort of conceptualizing these propositions that we'll come back to the question of scale and resolution in a bit. But let's just sort of like pull back a bit and sort of we saw yesterday the anthropos sort of in relation in a scalar relationship with the Earth, right? But sort of, so the idea is that how do we sort of also understand that those in terms of environmental violence, and that is at the same time entanglement of the environmental and political forms of violence that are sort of located at different scales. This is also a work that I made for the Whole Earth exhibition at the Hakeve and the beginning of the Anthropocene project, and it's important to sort of see that we're sort of here the last 2 years, but in a way, how sort of my work has also developed alongside the amazing discussions that we've been sort of sharing amongst all the participants, is to look at the Whole Earth image, but sort of zoom in on a cyclone that's captured in that image that was taken by the Apollo mission in November 12th, 1972. But in that cyclone that was captured was in the Bay of Bengal, which was the same sort of climatic storm system that produced the Bola cyclone, which would go on to catalyze a war of national liberation in Bangladesh and sort of reorganizes the way sort of climate sort of enters politics. Again, scales that are in conflict with each other, where the speed of the genocide is reacting or acting with sort of meteorological sort of force. But then politics follows, such as the Declaration of Independence that took place after the cyclone in November 26th, 1970, where environmental crisis and political revolution are sort of linked. But we would sort of argue as we go along that they're again linked in multiple ways.
Okay, so the next part of the presentation is a series of hypotheses that we're kind of putting out there as starting points. So the first one is that the Anthropocene works transversally, I probably should say, to existing political alliances, that there is something in the Anthropocene that challenges normal political categories, ones that are predicated on ideas of sovereignty of the nation state. And in fact, to ask ourselves the question of actually what kinds of emergent jurisdictions are being produced, what kinds of new alliances are forming, and what kind of criteria are these new alliances being based on? Are they based on something like shared risk? Are they geological alliances? Are they climatic alliances? And I think this is to kind of put forward the idea of a kind of a new politics with the earth, a kind of a proper geopolitics, as it were.
So within this frame, the first one might be that we need to cultivate a new cartographic imaginary. What sense does a line make in the context of something that's a transforming, shifting as a river delta? Lines that are important for law sort of define where law sort of operates are that at the same time that lines themselves are not law, and there's lines that are sort of disobedient, that there are lines that are wayward, mobile, and shifting, and unpredictable. Another way to articulate this idea of geopolitics might be the Ring of Fire, which is sort of this geological sort of formation that's taking place, going from all the way from Australia up to Alaska down to Latin America, where sort of minerals, resource extraction spaces, geological instability, and volcanic activity all collide. Could we imagine this as a new political alliance that doesn't follow geography, but rather a geology? An example of an area where I've been working is in West Papua in Indonesia, and the island of New Guinea has a sort of, just like the bird of paradise, which sort of symbolizes the island, has this enormous sort of fin going across it that sort of came through as a symptom of geology that brought sort of minerals to the surface as sort of the continental plates sort of collided. But at the same time that where politics followed as well as disposition and forms of extraction.
And we can see this already happening today. In fact, an example is the alliance of small island nation states, in this case, places that are susceptible to increasing sea levels. This time the land is being swallowed by the ocean. This is an image of the Maldives. And can we extend this idea? Can we imagine different kinds of alliances organized according to risk? How would that remap the existing jurisdictions, sovereignties on the planet? Can we imagine alliances of something like river delta cities, for example? Would a city like Cairo have more in common, or Alexandria have more in common with New Orleans? I think these are really kind of important questions. We can think of something that we're going to look at a lot more later on, which is the aridity line, which is the threshold of the, let's say, the desert and the non-desert. This is something that's both continually mobile, it's transforming, it transforms on a kind of seasonal basis, it's also being transformed by climate change, and as it transforms the livelihoods that are around it. And so, actually part of our project will be to, part of the seminar, will be to sort of take, to work together, in fact, to think through what kinds of new cartographic imaginaries we can produce and to actually map them out. This is going to be our task, and to map them out in terms of the disputes that are taking shape along them. Yeah? So we want to sort of understand this frontier condition along these different kinds of cartographies as a space of dispute, not as a space of that. In fact, these are the new things that are carving the earth up into different parts.
Absolutely, but at the same time, it's something. Something that's bringing the sort of the like geological line, such as the Ring of Fire, which might seem stable, but in fact is very unstable because of the Earth, because the Earth is sort of vomiting and sort of producing these very specific conditions for conflict, are sort of can be translated to meteorological sort of lines such as the aridity line.
Okay, so how to map new frontiers? According to new commonalities and differences. That's our project. So, another strange cartographic geometry. This is a project that formed part of my contribution to Grain Vapor Ray. And this is an image of what used to be Lake Chad. The last time Lake Chad had water in it, the Sahara was green, so it was many thousands of years ago. So it's very dry. In fact, it's one of the driest and the dustiest places on Earth. And the other image is of the Amazon, which is across the Atlantic, so it's quite far away. And the question that I pose is, well, in fact, what do these two places have in common? And what we find out is that scientists working a couple of years ago made an astonishing discovery that there's a jet stream which moves between the Eneti and the Tibesti mountain ranges in Lake Chad. And in an average 8-hour pulse of the jet stream, and I can see a... Is it going to play? Yeah. This little purple pulse, that's 700,000 tons of what used to be algae that had dried up. And scientists discovered that, in fact, this dust parcel was being carried all the way to the Amazon. So it was flying across the Atlantic. This is a LIDAR section through the atmosphere showing the dust parcel. More interestingly, they found that, in fact, the dust that was being carried from this very, very small part of the African continent, from the desert, being carried up into the air, deposited in the Amazon, played a fundamental role in the nutrient cycle of the rainforest. Yeah? So this has kind of astonished me, and I don't know too many examples of this kind of non-local nutrient transport. If there are people who know much more about these things than an architect in the audience, I'd love to hear more about them. But this kind of very strange non-local relationships that we start to perceive in the Anthropocene, and we're really interested in actually how do these new differences and new dependencies, and also the making visible of these new differences and new dependencies reorganize politics.
So. Sort of brings us to our second hypothesis, which is conflict over the frontier is always a conflict of representation. So in the earlier example, we sort of understood that looking for this dust comet across the surface of the Earth is in fact is something that it is to make it visible. But the question at the same time is sort of something that can be traced back to sort of colonial models of representation is that there it's not only a matter of making something visible, but rather that what is sort of represented as knowledge, and how can this be sort of mobilized in order to produce domination.
Okay, so the conflict over blank spaces on the map is replaced by a conflict over scale, over high and low resolution. So we know Marlowe Conrad's famous narrator in Heart of Darkness talks about the blank spaces of the earth, you know, and you can see like a map of Africa, a colonial map of Africa by a French cartographer, in which the blank spaces are kind of empty. And this was a kind of invitation to colonialism, yeah, to fill in the blank earth. And then, you know, at a certain point, there was an idea that everything had been mapped, in fact, that we'd kind of visited everything, that there was somehow nothing left to uncover. Everything that could have been explored had been explored. And we think that actually this is not the case. And there's a big transformation. And actually the transformation is that now the conflict is not over the blank and the full, or the empty and the full, let's say, but is over the high and low resolution. Yeah. So we can see here, for example, we know that satellite photography over Israel and over Afghanistan and certain other sensitive areas, let's say, on the planet, is controlled militarily. Yeah, and there's a question here about like what is included in the pixel, what is excluded from the pixel. And I think that conflict over the threshold of detectability is in a way like the new frontier. The new frontier of also colonialism in some way, but it's also the new frontier of activism, as a new frontier of resistance.
And a new frontier of representation. Those images, by the way, are part of the Forensic Architecture Project we're both part of, and that particular sort of case is has been sort of discussed widely, also at DACV, where we did the Forensis, the Architecture of Public Truth exhibition, which looks at particularly examining drone strikes over Pakistan.
Yeah, and I think that, of course, so these conflicts also extend now into the ground, into the atmosphere. I think this is also what's really new about them. But not only are they increasingly vertical, they're increasingly temporal. So, I mean, I'm sure Will can correct me, but you know, if you're a climate scientist, you're looking at everything from like the oscillation of infrared to 100,000 year long subtle shifts in like the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, from very very small aerosol particles in the air and trying to calculate the effects that they have. To looking at things like large-scale ocean currents, for example. And that kind of conflation of scale, that kind of juxtaposition of scale and how you actually start to manage that scale, I think, becomes fundamental. Of course, we know that this is not something that's only atmospheric. We now see able to see into the ground in new ways, and the way in which we see into the ground is having more and more effects on the way that we organize the surface. I think that's very fundamental. This is a image of oil exploration in Venezuela.
That is part of the research of Godofredo Pereira, who's going to be taking part in presenting the seminar over on Thursday and Friday. Our third point, or third hypothesis in this journey, is about sort of politics on the ground. Increasingly, we need to sort of also shift to look at how these problems of representation, right, are sort of interacting with sort of truth on the ground or sort of political sort of realities. And this one is particularly looking at the idea of domination and exploitation that are sort of colonial projects that haven't really gone away, but we were sort of but they've sort of transformed, and in a sense, the Anthropocene does it. What kind of tools or what kind of ideas does the Anthropocene sort of provide us, who are not necessarily claiming to be activists on the ground, but rather sort of operating in sort of academic projects or research projects or artistic work, and how can sort of the Anthropocene sort of be a productive sort of political sort of to make these imaginations connect to what's happening in very specific places, as sort of the seminar is going to look at. This is Joko Pekik, who's an Indonesian painter, made this painting called "Go to Hell, Crocodile." And it's sort of it's not trying to hide anything. It's not sort of pulling any punches. That the crocodile here is this monster, right? That's that's Freeport, the mining company, which I'm investigating along with the Papuan negotiator at the UN over it's a project that's sort of ongoing at the moment. And I'll show a few sort of archival images that, that I've collected from the archives of TAPOL, which is a human rights NGO working in Indonesia. And what's been interesting is to see how TAPOL, who are sort of a human rights NGO, have been at the same time working on sort of environmental violations, and they're really interested in sort of working with me to sort of look at how to connect what the work they're doing in terms of the human rights work along with these environmental cases. The Freeport is the mining company that exploits what I would say both Papuan space and time, because as these mining projects, as the open pit mine, which has one of the world's largest gold and copper reserves, is exhausted, it's now shifting to this Dante sort of inferno, which is a series of underground mines that are going to be opened and exploited over the next 30, 40 years. These images are from TAPOL's archive, going back to the 70s, of sort of unknown photographer that I couldn't find who it was. But I inverted the image and to think that the spiral that we saw and that the mine produces is something that's also looking to the underground, right? And so it's this sort of movement of violence that is transversal and is forming sort of these new cartographies of exploitation. The case in Indonesia is particularly interesting because it's at the same time a military occupation of West Papua and that sort of has taken the situation where it's a collusion between the state and the mining company and many other sort of environmental exploiters. The work that we're developing at the moment is quite a new sort of formulation of how environmental claims can be used to make territorial claims. If we sort of follow back to the case of what happened in Bangladesh in 1971, that sort of produced a sort of these origins of, in a sense, humanitarian politics, where that sort of malign interaction between the cyclone and the genocide, right, produce the kind of humanitarian politics that stayed with us, which is the military intervention used by India to sort of intervene in what they saw as a genocide taking place, as well as the first humanitarian rock concert. So culture and sort of politics sort of found a way to sort of cohabit this, co-produce this moment. But let's say in the case of Papua, we're interested in sort of articulating how mapping the environmental violations could be used as itself as its sort of territorial claims. These are sort of images that aerial images of the transmigration program that has been taking place in Papua by the Indonesian state that has been sort of claiming ethnocide rather than sort of a genocidal machine to sort of take over land and sort of transform it for its collusion with the mining company.
Yeah, I mean, and there are other examples of that. These are images of the Niger Delta, these conflicts with the Inagoni land, for example, with Shell, etc. Okay, so domination and exploitation do not go away, but they are transformed. The same forms of technical scientific knowledge are being mobilized both by perpetrators and by prosecutors of violence. This is another, I'm going to put the sound on, a video that I prepared for the forensic architecture show here. And it's footage from the Copenhagen Climate Conference. And it's footage which will... Oops. Maybe it's possibly slow to start. In any case, it's the lead negotiator, Lumumba de Aping, representing the G77, which is a group of 132 developing nations. And in a certain moment, in response to the proposed 2-degree temperature increase that was being circulated in a private document amongst the G20 nations, referred to as the Danish text at the time, he calls this press conference, for some reason it's not playing, and very famously has this outburst where he accuses the G20 of what he calls climate genocide. And he says that what this represents, this proposed 2-degree temperature increase, is a colonization of the sky. And he's representing, of course, a series of sensitive parts of the world, especially African nations, and actually making an argument based on research that would say that, you know, this 2-degree temperature increase was a global average. In fact, in many parts of the world, it's fine. In many parts of Africa, this would lead to sort of a 3 or 3.5 degree temperature increase, and that the consequences of this would be extremely severe in terms of increased mortality rates, exacerbation of existing conflicts, etc. And I think what's interesting about that is a kind of counter-mobilization of scientific knowledge within this political forum. And in fact, he bases his reasoning in the kind of dispute on scientific research. And I think that's what's quite interesting, is the way science, let's say, gets used by different kinds of actors. And in a way, the question that De Aping is posing when he makes this claim is actually, like, what is the scale of people within a climate model? And I think that kind of question of climate modeling scale, the scale at which people become visible or populations become visible in a climate model, is also extremely interesting. Anyway, that's fine. Okay, so number four, the Anthropocene needs teeth. Criminalize environmental violence. Well, we know that environmental violence is already, in many senses, already criminalized. But the Anthropocene presents new kinds of challenges. So in cases of environmental violence, activist claims depend on human testimony and scientific knowledge. I think that's something that's very important. A lot of activist work and a lot of humanitarian work is based on a tradition of human testimony. And I think actually now the kind of most interesting work amongst, let's say, like, activists is precisely the intersection then between different forms of techno-scientific knowledge and human testimony. We've just completed a project at UCL working with Amnesty International and Forensic Architecture, helping them to write a report on the recent war in Gaza, in which we were mobilizing people who were doing satellite analysis from NASA. There were field workers who were on the ground looking at, who were interviewing people. There were ballistics experts that were examining shrapnel. And I think it's precisely those kinds of intersections of different bodies of knowledge that we need to get better at producing in order to kind of mobilize these political claims.
In a sense, as sort of technoscience developed into the 20th century, again, as it became a complex systems, it itself sort of within it began to have these contradictions that we can sort of start to also mobilize. We're coming very close to the end of our presentation, and the sort of an idea that we'd like to leave you with is just to say that we must find ways of locating responsibility within this complex causal network. And this will be sort of what we'll address in the seminar. But it is to say that investigating environmental violence, as we sort of try to present it here today, it is sort of indirect and dispersed over space and time is challenging for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's often territorial, affecting a whole population whose transnational characteristics make it extremely difficult to assign responsibility to a particular state or non-state actor. Such violent entanglements have a real and devastating effect, not least because the number of sufferers so large, and often the urban and rural poor, who have little access to justice or the leverage to translate their local grievances into to the scientific and legal language of international forums. But also, secondly, that perpetrators of this kind of diffuse environmental violence continue to be held unaccountable. And to say when truth on the ground is such that there's little scope for the law's implementation, then claiming and evidencing, as we are proposing, themselves become political acts, that is the making of truths that speak to power.
So, our task is to imagine and map these new cartographies. Well, we have a very big wall. It's about 10 meters wide, I think, and we're going to make a map as a group Now, the idea is to try to get, in the short amount of time that we have possible, to kind of cultivate this imagination, to try to carve the world up according to these different cartographies, to these new lines, and start to map a series of case studies along this line over the course of the day and a half seminar.
Yeah, it's actually not at all realistic to sort of, obviously, in a day and a half to be getting so deep into a specific case study, but we will, particularly the work that A.L. Weisman has been doing recently around the aridity line, and as well as Adrian, we can sort of use that as a model, right, to then sort of quickly sketch out sort of projects that maybe the people in the seminar might want to continue.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.